Welcome to Read, Eat, Travel, Repeat, the book club and podcast with your hosts, Sarah, Kit, and Marianne, three friends who talk about all things books, food, and travel. Welcome, readers, eaters, and travelers to Read, Eat, Travel, Repeat, the podcast and book club where books take us beyond the page. I'm Sarah.
I'm Kit.
And I'm Marianne. Today, we'll be talking about The 13th Child by Erin A. Craig. Spoiler warning for anyone who hasn't read the book. While we will be giving initial thoughts and ideas, eventually we will be spoiling the end.
And we'll let you know when we get to that point, so feel free to listen up to then, give it a pause, go read the book, and then come back once you're done. And Normally here I say that we are adults and we're going to say adult things, but this book doesn't really lend itself to that, I don't think.
No, like, but it might just be our our general sailor language.
There we go. But by adult things on this one, we mean we're going to swear.
We swear.
There's going to be some cursing.
It happens.
All right. So who wants to talk about this book first?
Ma should.
Go for it. Yeah. We're going to start off strong.
So for me, this is not a book I would have ever picked up. I mean, we went through that whole big phase of dystopian and fantasy back when we were on Twilight Moms, and I just got tired of it. I got to the point where I don't like reading books that I have to work at, so I would never pick this up. So I did it on audio, and that was the best thing because I listened to it in the car or when I was riding my bike, and it's like I was trapped. Like, I couldn't, like, just set it down. And I don't mean that in a bad way.
A captive audience.
Yes, a captive audience.
That's exactly it with an audiobook. Yeah.
You know, because it's like, if I don't listen to this book, I'm going to listen to silence. So let me listen to this book. And I don't know that I would have gotten through it if I'd read it. But by listening to it, I got through it. And I really liked it by the end. There's a few things that I found were a little problematic. I thought the writing was really good. A couple of character flaws that I didn't like, but all in all, I enjoyed it and I liked the ending and I'm glad I read it. I don't know if I would pick up something else like this willingly, but now I know that if like my book club is doing something that I don't know, I'm going to go.
Yeah.
Because right now, like I'm listening to The Invisible Life of Addie LaRue.
Yes.
Which is, of course, narrated by Julia Whalen. And that's another one that actually kind of reminds me of The 13th Child in a couple of ways. That there's like this dark spirit that she sells her soul to. And so some of that kind of, and he just pops up periodically, like on the anniversary of their their exchange. And so it kind of reminds me of The 13th Child. But same thing, I don't know that I would have done well reading it, but by listening to it, I'm like really all in. So my advice, if you're somebody who's not huge into fantasy, is to listen to the book. I really like the narrator for the 13th Child.
I did too.
So that would be my advice, and I'm glad I read it. And so who is going to go next?
I'll go. I love, Ma, that you, this is what I love about us. It's not your normal genre. But you still picked it up and it was still like, oh, I do. I liked this. I do. I feel like the older I get too, I like listening to fantasy and this kind of thing more than reading it a little bit. Just, I think because of the names and the places, it's a little easier to get. So I'm a little biased because I love everything that Erin writes. I just love her writing. It's so good.
I agree. The writing was beautiful.
And, I love gothic horror. I love almost everything, I think, except her newest one. The newest one still is. Everything is fractured fairy tale. And they're often deeper fairy tales that a lot of people don't realize. You're not getting the typical, it's not like the Gregory Maguire stuff where you're taking Cinderella, and you're taking Snow White. Her other books,
lesser known.
Small Favors is Rumpelstiltskin.
Okay.
And it's more about like a beekeeper. So it's totally different. And then, House of Salt and Sorrow and Rot and Ruin, the series that is based off 12 Dancing Princesses.
Yes.
Which I love that story. So I love that it's like this gothic fairy tale. So pretty much anything that comes out by her, I will read. It helps that we went to the same high school and she graduated with my brother. That's a little cheater. But because I know her, but I do love her. Like I love everything about what she writes and how she writes and things like that. So what about you, Kit?
Can I jump in for one second? Is that is one nice thing about book clubs, whether it's our book club here or a book club in the community. That is the beauty of book clubs, is pushing you outside of your, which I liked. I went into it completely blind, not knowing what to expect. And I liked
can't
it.
Wait to talk about that one in depth on our October Reads episode.
Okay.
Because I'm I love that book. But.
And then same thing like with this. I mean, or Addie LaRue. I'm reading that from my workbook club. So that is the beauty of book clubs, is that they push you, it not get out of your like cozy little hole and expand your horizon. So with that being said,
I love that too. Yeah.
Kit, so, what do you think?
This book has been my favorite for a few years now, and I actually came upon it kind of like accidentally. So I do it like 5 or 6 times a year all over Colorado. I do a Why Kids Need Horror that's written specifically for them presentation, and we get like deep into like building capacity for dealing with hard things and like what different authors have said about why they choose to write for middle grade and YA kids, why they stick with the horror genre. It's one of my favorite things to do. But what I found was we were talking about one specific genre, and as a librarian, you never want a kid to get so stuck in a genre that they never read anything else, which, similar to what we were just talking about with the book club, that's what challenges you to get outside of the genre. So about the second or third time I started to do prep for the presentation, I was like, I got to crosswalk some books. Like, I need to, now that we've talked about these books that are very firmly horror, how are we going to get kids to branch out if all they want is scary things? And if you are a librarian and you're listening, you know the kids walk in and they're like, I want a scary book. And you're like, okay.
Yeah.
And then you're like, you've read all my scary books. Now what do I give you? So when I started digging into books that are horror adjacent, that had some of the same themes, like this one specifically deals with prophecy and the idea of like being cursed. And I read it and I was like, oh, this is good, because it's got the fractured fairy tale. It's fantasy. It has those horror elements. It has, for a lot of middle grade and YA, the idea of a found family.
Yeah.
Because a lot of time they feel like they're totally alone. Yep. Their real family doesn't get them. This, that, the other, kind of building a life for yourself. It hits on all these great things. So I started hyping this book up on my crosswalks section of the presentation. And what I found was, especially when I talk at actual high schools, like at their high school book conferences, the kids, first of all, the cover on this book is gorgeous.
It is.
When it's up on the screen, I get more kids, teenagers asking, tell me more about that book. Because I'll give like the very briefest overview, because it's a short presentation. And I'll be like, if you have any questions about any of the books, like, ask me. I get more questions about The 13th Child than any other book that I crossed.
There's skulls all over it with melting candles.
Yes.
Oh. Like
the kids, the kids love it. It's gorgeous. And I've had multiple students who, like, before they walk out of the room, are on Libby or on their library, like, account, reserving the
trying
book.
To get it. Yeah.
Yeah. And they're like fighting with each other over who's going to get it first, because it's such a, when you start to like summarize it, it's such a compelling idea of like, what if you were the 13th child and your family just gave you away? Like, before you were even born.
Yeah.
Didn't want you. Then what? And every decision was made for you from there. And what do you do? And they're like, yeah, I want to read that. I was like, yes, read it. So this book, it was interesting though, because I read it probably 2 years ago and talk about it all the time, but hadn't picked it back up again. So I got it to read again here. And I forgot how much I forgot, I guess. Like, as I was reading it, I was like, oh my God, I forgot that's how that happened. And I forgot how this played out.
There's so a much lot to it. How many pages? How many pages is it? I know it was like 16 hours on audio. How many pages is
it? It doesn't feel like it's as big as it is.
It's 400 something. 493.
Well, I mean, it's hefty.
But 494. Yeah, for sure. 494. So almost 500 pages. I think the pages just must be thin. Most of Aaron's books are pretty big. You can see them above my head.
There are
all Aaron's books right there, right next to my Emily Henry's. They're all pretty hefty.
But yeah, this is, I like this book for a lot of different reasons. So I was really excited when you said you knew her. I was like, oh my God, I felt like
I know.
Fucking Will Smith.
I know.
Will Ferrell. Oh my God, I know him.
I know him.
6 degrees of separation. I'm so excited.
I know.
Yeah, yeah. Love this book.
Yeah, she's a great person too, but I feel too like her writing is so good. We had the same English teacher growing up. So
nice.
I was just saying.
Shout out.
PH, she was amazing. Mr. Walbrink, if you're out there listening, I doubt it, but
if you are, maybe
someday I'll send him. I know he's still around. Our other, the other English teacher that we had, Mrs. Clark, we called her Clark Bear, because she was real grumbly, and she just passed away like in February. But I student taught with her. I was very close with her. So they were the two of the best English teachers. The reason I became an English teacher, and clearly why Aaron became a writer. So. You know, and I'm from a pretty small town. So it's really cool when somebody from your small town high school who knows your family is a New York Times bestselling author. So
that is pretty awesome.
And this book she just posted today, it's back on the USA Today bestsellers because the paperback just came out. Yep. So it's like back up. And Barnes & Noble has it as like a featured book. Yeah. So it's getting a lot of
perfect timing for it to come out.
It really is. I'm glad we picked it because it's just kind of getting fall-like. And I'm like, ooh, I like the kind of spooky vibes. I love books like this for that. So how about some plot points?
Yeah.
Which one do we want to do first? The first one listed?
Yeah, let's just go. Let's roll right down the list. Gift versus curse. I put that on there because it is kind of my favorite part of this book. Is that.
So are we getting into spoilers? Do we need to do the spoiler
alert? Yeah, we should probably warn everyone. Spoiler alert.
Go get this book, read it, and come back because it's really good.
It is so good. It is worth getting. Or
and it's being
listen,
featured at Barnes & Noble.
Yeah. I know some people. I'm saying it as if I'm not talking about myself. I know some people that just don't care if they're getting spoiled. I'm one of those people. I'm all for hearing spoilers because then I want to see how, like, okay, you've told me what happens.
Tell me what happened. How does this, how does this
happen? Yeah, like, how does it fit together? So I'm a person that doesn't mind spoilers. So if that's you, keep listening.
But if not, I was like screaming at one of my students today in seventh period, telling her not to spoil the Wordle for me. She's like, do you know a 5-letter word that starts with SP?
Stop!
You're doing the Wordle! Stop! You're spoiling it for me!
We have a software in our school called Land School.
That's what we have
too. I can pull up everyone's computer screen.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll do a test or a quiz online. And if they're done, they can go do whatever. And then I have everyone's screens up on my screen. And all of a sudden, I'll see like 5 kids pull up the Wordle. And I'm like, delete, delete, delete. Like close them down. I was like, I don't do the Wordle when you're done with the test, guys. I don't want to see the answer.
I don't want to know.
Or I'll tell them, I'll like, hold on. I'll get my phone out. I'll be like, do it really quick. And then be like, all right, now you may do the Wordle. Anyway. All right. So plot points.
Back to plot points.
Even though Wordle is an obsession of ours.
Gift versus curse. Let's get on to the actual point. Thank you. Gift versus curse. This is my favorite, to reiterate what I said 10 minutes ago. This is my favorite part of this book because I think it feels like the entire time that Hazel is having this argument with herself. That like, is, you know, being the 13th child is obviously considered by some people to be a gift that like you are bestowed with special powers or some supernatural kind of talents. Like for Hazel, it's her ability to heal that is she kind of has naturally, but that the gifts that are given by Merrick kind of enhance. Uh-huh. And then we find out that they're actually like that specific gift was given by like the first one. So there's like some kind of different things that she has to piece together. Mm-hmm. But is it really a gift or is it a curse? Because it for her, she's left alone in the in-between for a year.
Right.
Completely alone. And then has to continue
With books, which sounds amazing.
It does sound amazing, except for
books.
They're medical books. But also, like, because she likes to read. Like, she's interested in learning. She likes to read. It's a topic that she's interested in. But I kind of feel like she was a little bit like me in the way of, like, if someone tells you have to read this book right now, you're like, I don't wanna.
That is why our TBRs are so big. Because you want to read it for a hot second, and then push comes to shove, and you're like, I don't really want to read this right now. I want to read this. And then you go buy a new one. So
yeah. So I feel like that was like, I would love a little cabin in the middle of nowhere with trees that bloom all the time and books to read. But like, I have to read all of these books in a year. And like, I have, not only do I have to read them, I have to learn shit.
Yeah.
Like, it's not just reading for fun. But then she's kind of bestowed this like amazing life of having the cabin of her dreams. Mm-hmm. Like, even when she moves out of the in-between and she has the ability
her
to
little
heal
cottage.
Anyone. Like, yeah. You've
to,
learned
to touch
all this,
them
yeah.
and see what they what is the cause it, so that she
also
knows.
The
but
death
yeah,
plan.
Yeah,
yeah. So then it's I think at first it is a curse for her because of being alone, and then it kind of becomes a gift. But then it's like, but is it a gift?
But okay, but considering
and
that
I think
her
that's
family
where she
treated
struggles.
Her,
yes.
she was alone anyhow. At least now she was alone with food and clean clothes and a nice cottage,
right? Yeah. But then she finds out that. She's been gifted with three lifetimes. She's going to have to watch everyone she loves die.
Yes.
That's definitely
and
a curse.
That was so interesting. Yes. Like, to think that the whole lifetimes thing and the candles and the...
Personally, want to know so much more of, like, Merrick's backstory. Because he's kind of like an all-seeing, all-powerful god, but also is like a giant man-child.
Yes.
And, like, what was his... Like impetus, like he says, he knew he loved her as his own child before she was even born. He knew this was like the missing piece of his like life or his puzzle or whatever.
Yeah.
But then he was so like, it's like he was like, well, I got it, but wasn't the most loving and caring.
Because he didn't know. He even says like, when she's like, you left me alone. What do you mean? Like, I waited for you for 12 years to come get me and you didn't come. And then you came and got me, gave me a cake and left me alone. And he's like, that was bad.
Yeah. Like, he's just like,
I'm sorry. I had no idea. No concept of time. Like, was that a long time? Because
I
thought it was fine. I
would love to know more about him prior to kind of convincing them to give him Hazel. Like, what were you thinking, man?
I want to pull this original fairy tale out.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure I have a book of Grimm's fairy tales that I want to see if it's
in
there.
Because I'm
super curious to read, like, the original and the whole, you know, death. That fascinates me. So,
yeah. But I think in terms of like gift versus curse, I think that's what she's going through the whole time. And which kind of leads to like the next point too. But I think for her trying to figure out like, is this a gift or is this a curse?
Yeah.
And what do I do with it? Either way, whether it's a gift or a curse, what do I do with that?
Yeah. And then the fact that she has, the people that she does have to end their life, because sometimes as a healer, that's what she has to do is send them on to the afterlife, essentially, is the fact that their ghost then kind of haunts her. And Merrick has no idea.
Right.
He's like, what do you
like,
mean? When she finally
unaware.
Tells him, and he's like, she's like, I don't want to live like that. I don't want these people. And that's when some of the descriptions, that's where the gothic horror stuff comes in.
Yeah.
I mean, you're talking about the way she talks. It's not gross, like, to me, but strips of flesh hanging off the skull.
It
doesn't sound, it's not, like, scary to me. It just, like, I don't know, like, the way her descriptions are really fits that with the YA audience of still being kind of gross, but not, like, total gross out.
It's not, but it, like, you can imagine it as graphic or as like at arm's length as you want, like,
as
however
it
works for you.
Yep, exactly,
for sure.
Okay, so self-determination versus expectation versus obligations.
I think she fights with this one the whole time as well.
Yeah,
especially what I found was interesting was what Merrick expected of her is what she was already kind of trending towards on her own.
Yeah.
Like, she was already going into the woods and like assisting kind of like the healer that was in her town.
Yeah,
right. Like, this was already what she had kind of a proclivity for anyways.
Yeah.
But then it became the thing she had to do.
Mm-hmm.
And she didn't, like, similar to other things, like, Merrick wasn't the most helpful person on the planet.
No.
He was just like, just do the thing. Like, just, you can do it, just do the thing.
He was a man. He's clueless. I'm sorry.
So true.
Look at all the birthday cakes he brought her that she didn't like, you know?
That's my favorite part for later.
I know.
Leopold. I love that.
Same.
But I do think, like, I would imagine, at least for her, being like, I do like doing this work and I do think it's fulfilling, but I want to have some say in how it's done. And at the outset, at least, she doesn't really have a whole lot of say. It's just, this is where you're going to live and this is the job you're going to do. And
part of it, when you talk about lifetimes, about too, how she seemed to have a proclivity towards it, but she was blessed by Merrick at the beginning. And that was always his plan.
Yes.
So she kind of like, I don't know, was interested, but only because he made her interested to begin with, maybe.
Right.
Or so knowing that that was going to be her path down the road. So did she really have the whole full choice and the desire to do it? Or, and then again, I mean, I feel like with a lot of things, that I've heard this multiple times from people, that sometimes when you do what you love and it becomes, you do it for a job, becomes work, it's no longer fun.
Mm-hmm.
I've had many horse people tell me that before.
Yeah.
Like, I could do horses full time if I could, I'd ride and train or whatever. But they're like, when it becomes your job every day, you get tired of it real quick. Or like artists will say that. When you have to sell this painting because you have to have dinner, instead of like, oh, I think I'm going to paint today, or I'm going to draw, or I'm going to write, or I'm going to, the pressure's on to like,
oh, and then for
I have to do this. Yeah.
For Hazel, though, then too, especially then, there is that pressure that everybody expects her to heal. And if she doesn't, there's could be dire consequences, you know?
And when she can't explain what she does to heal either.
Right.
Right. Like, there's no way you can just be like, well, for reasons of magic, I see what the solution is right off the gate. I just got to touch your face.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then people will start to question. So.
Now I'm just like thinking more about it.
I know.
Wait a minute. I've contemplated it's more.
Every time we talk about a book, I always want to reread it again afterward, because I'm like, oh, I hadn't thought of that part. Oh, I want to do this one again too. Like, you know, and there's so much about her character that I find interesting. And Merrick.
It was interesting, like, how feisty she was at times. And she didn't stand down to him. And I
know.
Considering her family background, where she didn't really have much voice, it was like kind of surprising that like she was back talking a god. I don't know if I would be brave enough to do that, but I guess
even the royalty. Yeah. I mean, the royal family for a little bit. She definitely has some cojones.
Yeah,
to be able to do that. Yeah, she's definitely a strong female main character.
Yes,
for sure.
Which I think a lot of people enjoy. And being YA, essentially, truly being YA, even though Erin's one of those authors, I don't feel like it reads YA. It's not like simplistic writing. It's just,
the characters are that age.
Yeah.
Yeah, because there was a couple of scenes that were not spicy, but kind of implied spicy type.
Yes. But it's not descriptive.
Yes. But you know? It's like, I would say, high school YA, not like.
Yeah, high school YA. Some upper middle grades, though. Death to save.
Yeah.
That's such an interesting concept. It was one of those I almost like stopped and thought about it for a minute when he was like, well, sometimes you do. She's like, well, you told me I'm going to save everyone. He's like, well, you do. And sometimes killing them is saving them. And I was like, ooh, that's kind of a.
I also like that. Interesting that it didn't, when she had to deal with her parents, so she was brought back to her home and she was faced with both of her parents dying and what could she do to help them, and it wasn't explicitly stated in the moment, like when she was making this decision of how to kind of help them continue their journey to the other side, it wasn't explicitly stated. But later on, and I wish I had bookmarked it, she makes reference to the fact that her mother welcomed death. Her mother was ready and willingly took, I think, I forget which, she used a potion or
gave him some tea with poison in it. Yeah.
Yeah. And her mother welcomed it with a smile. Like she knew what was about to happen. She knew what Hazel was doing and she was ready, but that her father was not. And that, in that moment, she had to deal with both realities that some people know
he
what's
fought
about
it.
To happen. He fought it.
I think
it.
She says he fought it more, like didn't want to turn kid and didn't want to. Yeah.
See, that's one of the parts that I didn't like that much, just because it kind of, it's one thing, like assisted suicide, that if you're making the choice, but with her making the choice for them, that kind of goes into like eugenics almost.
Yeah.
You know, that makes me kind of uncomfortable. Like, that kind of gave me the ick. So,
yeah. I do think they did a decent job explaining, having Merrick explain kind of like what is the ramifications for if you know there's no remedy. Like, there is no, like, it'd be different if, like, well, maybe they could recover, like, if there was some sort of solution. Yeah. But I thought they did a decent enough job with there's no recovering for this.
Right.
There is no net positive. If he lives, then her brother and his fiance are coming home. They're going to catch it.
Yeah,
they're
like that explanation. Yeah.
And they're going to kill, you know. And I think if it was anyone but a god saying it, there's room for like doubt of like, well, how do you know that?
Right.
Yeah. But it's already been explained in the story that he sees all the different possibilities. And he's telling you that in every single scenario, leaving them alive kills all these other people.
Yeah.
And so I think it's still like an icky feeling, but I think that she did do a good job kind of explaining the why behind it.
But the one thing, like, if this is a YA book and we're adults and we're talking about it like this, and you know, I don't know that teenagers have that depth of consciousness.
Have that depth. I can tell you as a librarian, the conversations that teenagers have about books far outstrip most conversations that I hear adults have about books.
Yeah.
Like they, because and a lot of times it's because they're unwilling to compromise their own thoughts and opinions.
That's true.
They have so many thoughts and opinions, and they are willing to like go to bat on them. So, you know, sitting in the library whenever we did book clubs or whenever we had like kids reading like paired books, so like more than one kid reading the same book at one time, the conversations that even my middle schoolers would have about books were a constant shock to me because they picked up on stuff that I've outgrown. So we're looking
at it from one perspective with
one set of eyes and experiences and whatnot, but we're not in the weeds anymore as teenagers. And the things that they would pick up as what it would actually, like, we can talk about, like, gosh, that must have been really hard for Hazel. But if they're living in a house where, like, they feel like their parents aren't paying attention, like, if they're in it right then, the shit that they pick up on is crazy amazing. And the conversations they have are way deeper than I think most people anticipate they're going to be.
Yeah.
They would definitely pick up on that argument of, and like, the difference who gets to decide.
The difference of between her parents and Kieran.
Yes.
Because the parents, I feel like, was explained really well. Like, other people are going to get sick.
Yeah.
Because of your parents.
Yeah.
But with Kieran.
And they're going to die anyways. Your parents are going to die anyways.
He's essentially brain dead. Right. Like, he's. And that, I thought she really skirted around well, because that is a touchy subject. Like, if someone's left in a coma state, do you.
Yeah.
Unplug, do you? I mean, that's essentially what she was doing. Yes, he will continue to live. You can save him, but he will never be the same again. And so, but I feel like maybe because it was YA, that one was a little skirted over a little bit. Not in a bad way, but more like that might be a little deeper for her.
Mm-hmm. But see, I also felt like.
I felt like the parents was talked about deeper than Kieran was.
I felt like Merrick, it felt like he was jealous of Kieran, though, too.
Yes.
I think so.
That also was a little disturbing when he's telling her she has to kill him. And then there's that jealous feeling like, is this really because of.
Yeah.
That was like one of those things that, like I said, some character flaws when in the beginning, that was one of the things that, you know, I kind of struggle with, is like, is he telling her she has to kill Kieran because he's not going to make it, or because Merrick.
Right.
Doesn't like the fact that he's taking Hazel's attention away from him. So,
And I think that goes back to the last point of the like expectations versus obligations versus, you know, self-determination, that I think Merrick was pulling a lot of strings that in his mind, he's like, this is how it works. But without explaining anything to Hazel, she's like, but why though? Like, what the fuck do you mean?
Yeah.
Like, and I think there's, you know, when that specific instance, who, like, I did not like that she pulled the plug on him because she tried to save him. Like she did, right. She did the thing, and she was she was proud of herself for being able to accomplish that and like take what she had learned. And mm-hmm. Merrick was just like, "You fucked it up. Like that was the wrong decision to make," without ever really explaining to her that, you know, here's why. Here's why that's the wrong decision to make. And that goes back to like the gift versus the curse too, of like when you see the skull, when you touch someone's face and you see the death knell, the fates have already decided. And you can't change it. Even though we find out later she does have a little bit of wiggle room on.
Not always
changing it.
But not always the way like she wants to the good.
Yeah.
The other thing I was trying to find,
it for the good though?
Exactly.
Ultimately,
she might
think
it's for the good, but
no, I think ultimately it was for the good for her, because then she didn't have to watch her friends die.
Yeah,
that's true.
Did she know at that point? Did she know she had the 3 lifetimes at that point?
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, she finds out.
I don't think it was with Kieran, but it was
not with Kieran.
Not with Kieran, right? Yeah,
but. Like with some of the others, though, that she...
I think it's after Kieran is when he takes her to the in-between again and explains, like, this is what you have. I was going to say that there's some foreshadowing in there, too, about trying to find the spot where... when he's like... Oh, I found it. Oh, my gosh. Can't believe I just flipped to it. Kieran would never hurt me. You don't know that. But you do, I said playfully, nudging his side. You see everything, and you know that all will be well. You can see how happy he makes me. And Merrick says, it's only going to make things harder. Mm-hmm. And I knew right away, I was like, Kieran's going to die. Something's going to happen. Because I thought first just the jealousy, but then part of me was like, Merrick's also kind of trying to protect her too, which he shouldn't do. Like, I don't want you forming human relationships because people are going to die.
Yeah.
And that's not okay either. But as soon as I read that, I was like, oh no, he's going to die.
Oh yeah, because he knows that she's going to live 3 lifetimes, and so
I was reading that,
and he probably knew it was going to happen soon. It was literally the next day he's like, "I know that it's coming." It's candles like this,
yeah.
You know,
as I was reading that section, I was trying to figure out if Merrick was going to orchestrate his death.
Same, I was like, "Oh,
like is he just because on one hand he could be." Just kind of, he knows what's going to happen.
Yeah.
And he's trying to, in his own maybe kind of fucked up way, to protect Hazel.
Yeah.
Like, you are going to have to say goodbye to this guy.
Yeah.
Even, you know, and I can't do anything about it. Because at the end of the day, Merrick is also kind of beholden to the whims of the fates. Like, mm-hmm. he doesn't seem like someone
that he can't control it. Right?
Right.
We learned that he can't control it. Like, he's like, it's not as simple as, it's not me deciding.
Right.
Right.
This is pre-decided when people's candles are lit. This is pre-decided. I'm just there to help them cross over. So being the god of death, he's not one that comes in and brings death necessarily, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah.
Because I thought the same thing. I was like, he could stop it. And he's super jealous.
Yeah.
And he's not going to, but it's like, no, he can't stop it.
And then I was like really worried that like, not only is he not going to stop it, but he's going to orchestrate it. I really thought she was going to get over there and discover that, like,
oops, sorry, I pushed him and he...
Yeah, like, he had done something to, like, push it towards that direction so that Hazel would leave without any ties. And I don't think that's the case, but, like, as I was reading it, I was like, oh, no. Like,
please,
don't be that guy.
Please
don't be that guy.
Exactly.
But I do think he... Like, there's several points where you're like, come on, man. Like, can't you bend a little bit? Like, can't you? Which he did obviously bend a little bit right out the gate because he granted her 3 lives. Like, he was willing to negotiate.
Yeah.
For his own benefit.
Yeah.
Which, how dumb are you? Like, that you think she's gonna, that's a human. You think she's going to want to live 3 lifetimes? Like, in what world do you think that's, like, the choice that she would make?
But he's also being a god. He doesn't...
Yeah. He doesn't understand it at all.
He doesn't understand that. Doesn't
like, why
think about
he?
It. Yeah.
For sure. Which I guess brings us to Grimm's fairy tales and how this connects to Godfather's.
Looking this up a little bit, because like I said, I love the fractured fairy tales. I also love that Aaron picks the like I said, the not so popular fairy tales, because I had to look this one up. I was like, what fairy tale is this based on?
Yeah.
And then I'm like, oh, I got it. So
I'm looking
at it. Yeah, except the real one's a boy.
Yeah.
And he, same thing, 13th
same
child,
story.
He becomes, becomes the famous physician. I'm definitely going to read this one. So I love a fractured fairy tale. I'm pretty sure after our Twilight conversations, I went and I bought a book of Grimm's fairy tales. I went and bought a Hans Christian Andersen. Yep. Like I was like obsessed with all the fairy tales and I've read a bunch of them and I've not read the 13th child.
Section on my wall that's like all of those books that I bought.
Parenthood and guardianship. That's an interesting one, too. You know, that's interesting being a YA novel, too, because, like, you talk about that. Like, I know we have more students than I think a lot of people realize that have guardians versus parents.
Yes. Yep.
And that's, I'm sure they're kind of like, wait, you know, I don't live with my parents either. And their parents are still around.
Yes.
But they don't live with them.
Yes.
Because their parents couldn't take care of them or for whatever reason. And so the fact that Hazel has a godfather that can take care of her and feed her and clothe her, but is not, even though he's not always there, like it's not a total.
And is it a better situation than she came
right
from?
Right.
He's like the divorced dad who gives you all the stuff, but doesn't know when to check in and see if you need like tampons or something, you know?
Right. I don't know what those are.
It was interesting too, like, and obviously, like, she didn't spend a ton of time on it because there's 12 of them. But when she starts talking about where all her other siblings have gone.
Yeah.
And where, you know, little tidbits kind of dropped, you know, her one brother was taken in by the Fractured, I think.
Yeah.
Or the Holy First. Her one, the what? No, the Fractured.
Birdie was the Fractured.
Yeah, Birdie was taken in by the Fractured, which it should have been her, but Merrick had already claimed her.
Yeah.
So Birdie was taken by that. The other brother is getting married and whatnot. We find out later on that some of the older sisters had families. They ended up dying in the war.
But she has nieces
that are alive and living at essentially at the missionary.
Yeah.
And at the mission.
Yeah, that's right.
The rift.
The rift, yeah.
Yeah, so we get these little tidbits about her family. And I thought it was really interesting. And again, like if Aaron wanted to write a whole series about different characters, like I think we got a really solid story about Hazel, but I would love to know more about Merrick's backstory.
Mm-hmm.
I would love to hear Birdie's story.
Yeah. Yeah.
And don't change where he ended up because he believes he ended up in a great position.
Like right. Birdie and he was terrified at first.
Yes.
And then he talks about, oh, it's okay. Like all these cuts, I willingly did this and I loved it.
Right.
Like you're like, what?
Yeah.
You were terrified before.
100%. It made me think of, was in one of the Dan Brown books. I forget which one it was, with the character that is like constantly flogging himself and like ripping strips off of his skin as like penance and punishment, but also to show how devout he is. And it really made me think of that because Birdie was given up too. Like he was given to the Fractured and he proved himself a loyal kind of subject, but at what cost? And then the fact that he walked away at the execution, like he walked away from Hazel, like I've been given a great.
Yes.
I forget the words he used, but essentially like he's been given the gift of doing this big thing.
This is what I'm. Yeah.
This is what I've, you know, been made for.
Yeah.
And what I was chosen for. And he's really proud of himself. And it is an absolutely horrific task that he is given.
Mm-hmm.
And he does it willingly and enthusiastically. And I would love to hear how he went from like the brother, really the only one who saw her.
Yes.
At the outset. The only one that realized it was her birthday. The only one that wanted to make sure that like she was celebrated too. To someone who willingly and enthusiastically beheads a child.
Yes, exactly. And seems celebrating.
Yeah.
Celebrate it. Not just like, oh, it's my duty, but this is the way it is and I'm celebrating it. And you're like,
I've been chosen.
Shocked on that part. Like, wait, did he just do what I think he did? Holy crap.
I kind of had an inkling that's where he was headed and I was like, oh, no. But at that point, like when I kind of knew where he was headed, I thought it was just the brother that he was gonna, like, the betrayer.
Yes.
Uh-huh. And I was like, all right, like, that's pretty typical for, like, this kind of story where, like, he's gonna behead him. Like, yeah. But when they brought out the wife and child, I was like, oh, no.
Like, well, because it's a cult, you know? I mean, yeah. It's like, yeah. You know, I mean, think about it. And the things that, what's his face? Jim, what was the one with the Kool-Aid? I thought they were, like, down somewhere down in, like, Central America, but the same thing. But, like, the things that people will do for their cult leader to stay in their good favors, you know? So Birdie was, you know, wasn't necessarily acting on it, wasn't Jim thinking Jones. Through that. Jim Jones, that's who it was.
Jim Jones, yep.
Jonestown man.
But he wasn't thinking about it so much rationally as I'm just been given this honor by this person that, you know, I've given my allegiance to. And,
yeah.
And that's, and was kind Birdie, of, that's kind of a scary commentary.
Yeah. The 12th child. Was he the next youngest?
Yeah, he's the next in line. Yeah. That's why they were
so I think close. I think it's interesting to, like, think about the older children had the luxury or ability to kind of, like, go off and get married and whatnot. And the younger children were essentially sold off.
Yeah.
Because the parents did receive some sort of, some level of monetary payment.
Yeah.
For both of them. And they were sold off. Which puts them kind of in the mindset already of, like, I'm not wanted in this one place, but this place does want me. And I don't want to lose that.
Yeah.
So what do I need to do to keep some sort of safety and structure, even if it's, like, really fucked up? What do I need to do? And for Birdie, that was, you know, essentially,
you know, it's fun. We were driving through Clearwater the other day. And, you know, Scientology is very big in Clearwater. Mm-hmm. And I was telling Jerry something about what I think I told you guys about when I was reading listening to Lisa Marie Presley biography about how the times in her life when she was in the best, like, mental state seemed to be when she was involved with Scientology, you know, and Scientology, it's very controversial. Is it really a religion? All that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. But that structure and that belonging helped her, you know, whereas for, like, the average person who doesn't have any money and they're bleeding them dry, that's problematic. But for her, it was actually a positive thing because when she didn't have that structure, then she struggled with drug abuse and, so same sort of thing for Birdie and for Hazel or for Birdie, he has that structure now that he can, he's not looking at the bigger picture of what he's being told to do because of that cult he's in. He wants that acceptance and that belonging.
He, like, lost his morals. I mean, because that's what, like, Hazel struggles with the whole time is the morals. Birdie they're just gone. Like, he's like, oh, it's okay, that's what they want me to do, and the gods favor me, and so I'm just gonna be okay with being an executioner.
That's why I think it'd be super interesting to see to be able to see what his life was like during that time.
Yes.
Like, did he quickly kind of succumb to that kind of brainwashing? Yeah. Or did he struggle like Hazel did? Like, did he try to hold on to those morals that we kind of know he had just by virtue of the way he treated Hazel when she was a child? But did he hold out? Was he able to kind of, like, reflect at all on his decision? After he sees Hazel and, like, does his job as executioner, like, is there any remorse there at all?
Yeah.
Like, I would love to know more about kind of how he felt.
Some of those other gods felt a little more sketchy than Merrick did.
Yeah.
You know, like, Merrick, I don't know if he just had a lot more meat to him and, like, you know, his personality, even though he's the dreaded one, like, it still felt. The others, I was just like, okay, they're, like, creepy gods. Like,
I also feel like Merrick's job as a god is very cut and dry in terms of, like, if you're the god of death and you don't get to choose when people die, but when it happens you are there,
you're there,
right? Versus, like, so he's not making any decisions, he's not really manipulating too much because he has a very specific task, whereas, like, the Fractured, I felt like we're fucking around with everything the whole time.
Especially, well, Calamity and
Felicity. Felicity and Calamity. And she literally is like, and the hundreds of other gods trapped in their body. It's just Felicity and Calamity were the two that popped up, but they spoke like 100, like there were many, and they're trapped.
And even they were vying for power over each other.
Over each other, yeah.
There's a lot, and then we don't get a lot about the Holy First in terms of like what exactly is happening over there, but you do get the sense that like she's pulling lots of strings.
Well, isn't what's her name, Margot?
Yeah,
Margot's part of the Holy First, right? And she's
well, no, we're led to believe that she is.
Yeah. Oh, we're led, you're right.
Oh, spoiler alert for you, Sarah, because you haven't finished.
It's okay.
Yeah,
she's gonna finish it tonight.
So Margot is not.
Have you done the Wordle yet?
Holy First.
No. It's been a long week, okay?
Dude, literally. But yeah, so we don't know a ton about the Holy Verse, but Merrick does seem like the most cut and dry of the three gods. But it still is still sketchy.
I did look up a little bit because I was curious. The going back to the fairy tale thing a little bit, and it does say that the Godfather Death is a very short story.
Okay,
and Aaron has turned it into a fully fleshed out novel by giving Hazel a backstory.
Yes.
So, and knowing Erin, I bet if we asked her some of these questions, like,
tell us
about Birdie, she probably has it all written down.
Tell me more about Birdie.
I'm sure she has it written down in one of the many notebooks she has.
Yeah.
Where she plots everything. She's one of those writers that kind of fully sculpts everything. And that the ending is different than the original.
Mm-hmm.
Because she wanted a heroine who struggles to do good, learning, making choices, not just obeying abstract fate.
Yeah. And I think that, I think she wrote it really well too, because there's so many points in which Hazel could either like fully disobey and like really turn her back on the whole thing or go the route of Birdie and like fully submit to the fate.
She was strong. She was strong. Yeah. So she questioned.
Yes.
But was able to think through sometimes and be like, oh, you're right. That's kind of not what I'm going for.
That's not really what I'm hoping to do here. Or trying to find ways around different things. I don't know where you are in the book, Sarah, but
I'm like literally.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you, what did I just read?
What'd you just
read? Right after the execution and Leopold is like, so I'm like, I'm there. You know?
Yeah, you're almost there. The
Brilliance, the thing, the gold.
You are not there yet where I don't think where she puts together how all of that came to be.
No, but she has realized the brilliance causing King Marnier's madness, like it altered him. Like her first thought of maybe she shouldn't have saved him because he's not the same he was, and why is he so angry? He said he was going to do this. And then he was influenced by Margot and
all this.
So Margot, you can spoil the ending for me. I'm still going to read it.
Margot is responsible for literally everything.
I figured that.
So, yeah.
Margot.
Yes.
Because she was also the seer that wanted Hazel to even come.
Yes.
So it tells me she's got
then
something.
Margot also like steered Hazel away from finding the correct potion,
the actual potion,
What I found super interesting, and I don't know that I got it the first time because I was reading it for different reasons.
Yeah,
was the physical manifestation of the radiance mimics the sap that is also the cure.
Yeah, that makes sense. Because she has already figured out that's from the sap from the trees, because that's what's burned in the
holy...
It's also the king's colors.
And it's also that sludge that you like bleed out. It's like sticky sap, like skin with it.
But when it first comes out, it's golden, and then when it gets burned, it's kind of that black sludge. Yeah. So it's very, very herbal all the way through. And Hazel's like so close to figuring it out before Margot's like, just kidding. Like, you should
It's geranium. It's geraniums.
And, you know, she figures it out by piecing together like the smell from Leo's
cologne. Yeah.
But I found the way that the disease manifests of like it's peeling off the same way it would like peel off of a tree. I loved all of that. And I really loved how Aaron like fed you little tidbits so that at the end you're like, oh,
loved it.
The colors and the way it worked.
Like, yeah.
It all fits together.
She like created a plague.
Yeah.
I was like, this is like the coolest disease ever. Like,
yeah.
They're bleeding gold, but it's not gold. It just looks gold. And then it's sludgy. And it pulls your pores apart. It's so thick and gross that you just like lose a chunk of your cheek. Like,
have you gotten to the ball yet? That's after the.
I think that's next.
That's next.
Yeah, that's right. Because it's a celebration of the execution.
Celebration of the execution. And Margot is still pulling strings and basically alters the plague. And Hazel has to decide how she's going to save who gets sick. Because it's supposed to be Leo that gets
Leo,
sick.
Leo, of course.
And it's not. And she has to figure out. And then there's like a whole thing with the older sister who like maybe is not the king's kid. And his madness is now driving him to like try and kill her. And like how she, there's
because
like this
last
little section.
A whole bunch of.
So much happens.
Yes.
And the
Which
way
is not like the fairy tale, I believe.
No.
Like it's not. Yeah.
And the way Aaron resolves it, I thought was brilliant. You think it's going to happen one way, and it kind of does, but it takes this little side, just a tiny little sidestep. We go back into the in-between with the candles, and it takes the tiniest sidestep because she's willing to give up her candle again to say who it is. But it really goes to that last plot point that we have on there, the what does a life well-lived mean, and how do we justify the impossible choices? Because she's making an impossible choice. Leo has roped himself into it because he's not willing to let her sacrifice her life.
Her life for,
right. So they have to, it's very impulsive decision making that they're doing, but I think it speaks to like, they've kind of come together. He wants to change who he is for the better.
Yeah.
She wants to have more self-determination in how she lives this life, whether it be one life or two lives.
Well, and that's what she doesn't care as much about the quantity of lives. Yeah. It's the quality.
And
that,
of lives.
I pulled that straight from Aaron's website. I thought that was interesting. That's kind of how the novel's described. And I was like, that's like the theme right there. That's what you're, the kind of things we've been talking about, you know, impossible choices for people we love and how do you live a good life because of that, you know, the morals and everything.
Yeah. And that, the final kind of like climax of this decision that they have to make, I'm trying not to give too much away because I don't want to tell you what it is, but they have to decide. But I thought it was and it happens super fast where like, there's this moment of clarity where Leo can see how his life is unfolding. Hazel sees how her life is unfolding and making that snap decision of what kind of life do I want to have?
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's not necessarily what has been laid out in front of me either for Leo, because even though he's not like a 13th child and like saddled with like a curse, his life is preordained. He is going to be the next king. So his life very much, and he speaks on it several times about how he doesn't want to fall into bad habits. He doesn't want to become that kind of like pompous prince that he was. He wants more for his life.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end, they have to make that decision. And it is kind of an impossible choice.
And I love that it's Hazel's conversation that causes him to want to change at first when he enrolls in the army, because she's kind of like, it's her, how bold she is.
Yeah.
To be like, listen. You may think you're all that, but
you're really not.
You're not. And he's kind of like,
did,
whoa, the first like, girl that's turned me down. And now I'm like really interested. You know, I liked that he, and it wasn't like overnight. Like he
struggled,
like, went away for a year.
Yeah.
She didn't see him for a long time when he was in the army or whatever. And so it wasn't like, okay, I'm new. I'm a new person. Come date me. It was like.
And when he came
back. You're right. You're
like,
right.
The other soldiers were with him and he was still like struggling to like.
Yes. Yes.
What are going back to like expectations? Like, what are the expectations for me now that I'm back in court? Which is very different than what the expectations were when I'm out on a battlefield.
Yeah.
I did like that he remembered her though from like the beginning when he was
to
her.
Yeah. Yeah.
I liked that he remembered that he was like, I remember your freckles.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, you're adorable. like, I thought it was cute that he was like, I remember you.
She's like, I remember you too. You're an ass. Like, yeah. I love that she was like, cool. I also remember that
moment.
Like,
great.
It was not, not great for me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Glad it was so memorable for
you.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
What but about some of these, some of these quotes?
So many. I started putting them in order, but that first one is definitely from the end. But it is my, it's my favorite quote in the book, because I think it goes back to some of the other, the conversations we had about the poppy fields and about
grief. Yes.
Like, okay. I think it connected nicely, and it's the, a wish was nothing but a hopeful regret. And here at the end of my life, I had none. And that also ties to the last plot point of like, what does it mean to have a life well lived?
A life well lived.
She didn't regret any of the
regrets.
She ended up exactly where she wanted to be, even though there was a lot of, you know, meddling by Merrick there at the beginning.
I love that. I feel like that's how I feel like we all want to be.
Yeah.
You know, like that's the goal of humanity.
Yeah. But I really liked the way it was worded, that a wish was nothing but a hopeful regret.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't wish for anything else. Like, what a great way to kind of close out a life.
Yeah.
For sure.
All right. Not magic, my grandfather corrected me, sounding sharper than I've ever heard him. The swift change in tone was so abrupt. I stumbled in my dance, coming to a stop. Power, he said. There's a difference between the two, don't you think?
I think that was an important distinction that Merrick made. Like, because that's very early on in the book.
Early when they first met, I think, at first at her birthday or something. Or like, she's still kind of getting to know him.
Oh, gosh, it's magic.
It's magic. And he's like, it's not magic. Yeah. Yeah.
What I thought was interesting was I felt like he was trying to, like, sell her something. Do you know what I mean? Like, he's trying to convince her that I'm about to hand you all the power in the world. But I don't know that was really a selling point for her. Like, I think she was more enchanted by the magic of it all.
The magic than the power.
Yeah.
Yeah. But
he was like, it's power.
Yeah. There's a difference. There's a difference between that.
And I was just thinking, like, power is what, it's not magic that has Birdie, like, kowtowing to.
Yeah.
It's power.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think Hazel bought into that quite
as well. No.
I think that was a poor play on Merrick's part. Like, I think he's taken by the power. He likes the idea that he is a all-powerful god and that's his place in the world. Uh-huh. And she's like, all right, like, whatever. But, like, you can do magic. Like, how cool is that?
How cool is that? You just, like, snapped your fingers and I have a house.
I got a cape. Yeah. Also, like, I said I'd like some trees and you grew them.
And you're like here's a tree.
I think that was a bad read by Merrick on, on Hazel's wants.
He's a man. He's a man.
True. Yeah, yeah. I also like the next quote I had in there I thought that was something that Hazel really had to like understand was it's just death is part of the journey, isn't it? It's a balance. If you have a beginning, birth, you must have an ending. And this is Merrick talking. So he says, me, do you see? And I think for Hazel, like she didn't really see to start. She was like, no, I'm the healer.
Yeah.
That's my place in this.
I feel like that would be a important quote for like kids who are dealing with a loss, though, too.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know, that is part of the journey. It's you got a beginning of a book. You got an end of a book. You got a beginning of a life. Yeah. You got an end of a life. It's just part of the journey.
For sure.
I think the next one we have here goes with that, too, that no one life is greater or lesser than any others. In the end, all mortals are dust. So it's like talking in the beginning of like this quote I had there where he's like, everything has a beginning and an ending and not one is worth more than the other, which I think is, that could be pretty powerful for kids too, when they think like, my life is awful. And it's like, but is it? Like, it's a life.
Yes.
You know, that could be.
Yeah. And I think in this instance, it's something Hazel needed to hear because she's contending with, like, I might have to kill the king.
Yeah.
And how do I go about that? Because I'm immediately going to be in lots of trouble.
Yes.
Like, if, and not even
they're
going
to come like, after me. They're going to come after me. They're going to know I did it. They're going to.
Even if it ends up feeling very natural, you at a bare minimum didn't save him.
Mm-hmm.
And like for her to understand that like
when she was dealing with her parents' death, them living would have all these ramifications, and she could kind of see how that played out. But then looking at the king, she's trying to rationalize it in the same manner of like, well, if I kill him, this is what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. Like these things that, you know, the brother's going to come in and take over the throne and like everything that Margo is like feeding into her ear. But if I don't, you know, if I save him, what's the ramifications? And she just couldn't parse out kind of the consequences of her actions until she was in the middle of it.
Like, done fucked up.
Yeah.
Yep, exactly.
Yes. And she couldn't, but I think for her hearing that, like, a king is just a man.
Yeah. One life isn't worth more than the other. Yeah. Just because he's a king does not make him worth more than the farmer down the road.
Yeah.
So.
And then the next quote I have in there, this was from like the very end.
It also kind of ties into these two ahead.
It's a very long quote.
So, and another one too that kids, I think, need to hear, you know?
And it's one where like I found myself, well, let me read the quote first. So sifting through my years, I was amused to realize that the best memories I had, the ones I longed to play over in my mind again and again, were the days of seemingly no importance. The ones full of laughter prompted by jokes, I no longer remembered. Rainfalls and sunsets, picking clover with my daughter, the soup Leo made one winter that still caused my mouth to water. Little snippets that looked like nothing, but were everything, comprising the brightest threads in the tapestry of my extraordinary long, but altogether too short life. Like when I read that quote, I was like, oh yeah, like I highlighted, like, I was like, I couldn't even parse out like a piece of it. I was like, the whole thing is important.
Yeah.
But I think it's one of those things that is like so important to remind people, because we tend to look at these like giant milestones of like, here's the day that I, you know, performed on stage. And like, here's
the things,
but, like,
you think are important.
Yeah.
Aren't really important in the scheme of things.
Right. Because they're just accolades.
Well, you know, but even though too, like, I've always hated New Year's Eve because people feel like compelled to be jovial and partying and getting drunk on purpose. And that, I've never had a good time at that. It's like, I've always had a much better time in the things that just randomly happen, you know, that that's what it makes me think of.
Yeah. And I was thinking of like theater, like doing musicals and stuff, where like the everyone thinks of like, you know, you rehearsed, you're right in the middle of it right now, Sarah. But like, I was thinking about how like, I used to do 4 or 5 shows a year. I couldn't really tell you, looking back the 20 years, very many things about like the performances that happened.
Yeah.
But I can give you a million examples of the stupidest shit we did during rehearsal when you're overtired and you're you know, you're messing up, like the blooper kind of things. Like, those are the things I remember. And when I see my theater friends, you know, and I'm back in town and whatnot, we don't talk about like, hey, you remember that time we did Jesus Christ Superstar on the show? No. We talk about the time that we got locked out of the building in February in bikinis because we were trying to run from the one stage door. We needed to come in the other stage door, which required us running around the building because otherwise you were going through the audience. Mm-hmm. And we got locked outside and we're in bikinis and sarongs doing jokes.
And the show's going. You're pounding on the door. And
100%. But those unexpected moments. And we made it on stage and we were covered in snow while wearing bikini. We looked ridiculous because we came in from the back of the stage. But that's the memory I have of that show. Not the we did the show for 7 years. So literally hundreds of shows that went off without a hitch.
Yep. Yep.
That you would think would be like the highlight. Those aren't the things you remember. You remember all those little things that kind of went awry, but were so funny and made good story.
It's those core memory things. I feel like as we get older, we appreciate those things more. Like I tell people too, like something will happen. And there's only one I'm thinking of right now. I know I have a few that they'll like come up and I like literally, it's a weird moment. One of them is, this is so weird. So I went to Italy for the second time. Kara was with me, my oldest daughter. And we were in Europe for 3 weeks. We did our tour of Italy with my group, and then we stayed for another 10 days to visit our exchange students. And we had to take the train from Rome to Pesaro, which is where my one exchange student was from. Mm-hmm. And it was the night before Taylor Swift's album. It's one of the Taylor's version of, oh my gosh, why am I blanking? The Speak one, that one that I like about.
Yeah,
the,
yeah, yeah.
And it's like core memory for me, sitting on the train with Kara, both of us listening to that album at the same time. We spent 3 weeks in Europe. And that to me is like my brightest memory of just like that mother-daughter bonding of sitting on a train. Mm-hmm. First time I'd really been in Europe by myself. Like I had to get us on a train from Rome to the other side of Italy to a non-very tourist town to meet up with Susie. That's what I remember. Not all the places. I mean, I remember all the places, but that is the feeling attached to that too, of just sitting there being
and
like.
It's when someone says like, what, you know,
yes.
Tell me about
and
that.
I hear,
that's the thing
and
that
I hear that heart. Song, like I'll hear Castles Crumbling, one of my favorite songs. And I'll immediately go back to that train and think of what it looked like outside when we were driving by. And that's a core memory for me of like, but it's not. Remember the time we went to the market and we ate all this weird food and we had here. I mean, like, I remember that, but I don't. That's not the first thing I think of. So it's those little core memories are the ones that you think of, not the bigger ones, you know, from people. So,
okay. And our next quote goes totally left field.
It does. It's perfect. It'll be perfect because it'll transition us into not talking about the deep stuff. I had to put this one down because it's an ode to Aaron's former job. Marnier, that's why I was like, you guys aren't going to know this, but King Marnier had carried out their murders cheerfully with all the spectacle of an operatic villain.
Was she an operatic villain?
No, Aaron went to school. That's how she knew my brother in high school. She stage managed.
Okay.
In our theater company. She went to school to stage manage.
Oh, that's awesome.
And she stage managed for, I don't know, I think it was close to 10 years before she decided to write full time. Mm-hmm. And she specifically used to stage manage a lot for operas.
Ooh. Okay.
And spooky operas. So dramatic. Like the really like deep ones.
Yeah.
So when you look at her bio, she talks about that. That's one of the reasons she likes Gothic horror. So I kind of felt like that is so funny because that's so her, an operatic villain. Like that is an ode to like her former life as a stage manager of operas.
Such a good description, too. Like, it's a very simple description.
Yeah, most people who don't know or aren't going to catch it, but I'm just kind of like, that's one of the other things we have in common is we talk theater forever.
Yeah, literally.
We talk books, and they're like, and theater. Let's talk theater for a while.
Yeah.
So.
No, I liked that line because that moment when, like, Hazel's like, oh, this motherfucker is going back on what we talked about. Like, come on.
Yeah.
And is reveling in it. Like, that, the description of, you know, all the spectacle of an operatic villain is like, you know exactly what that means. Like, you know exactly what
she
that
says. Like. Let's see, in her bio, she stage managed tragic operas with hunchbacks, seances, and murderous clowns.
Perfect.
Ooh.
And then decided she wanted to write books that were just as spooky. So I was like, I kind of love that whenever you have like an ode to your former life or whatever. Your
I really
career.
Liked just it made me think about it. I really liked her acknowledgments on the audiobook.
I read the acknowledgements in the book too. They're pretty
but
solid.
I think she reads them in the audiobook, and I really like them. That was like one of my favorites that I've read.
I do like hearing all of the kind of like behind the scenesy kind of stuff, like who helped you get through this.
Yeah, golly, I do too. I'm always like, do I know anyone? Like, just of all the book people we've met over the years, I'm like, I know this person? And or never... even the connections between authors, where I was like, oh, they're friends?
We're
like,
friends?
They're in the same reading group? Like, I read her books, too. And then I'm always kind of like, oh.
That's like, there was something that popped up on Facebook Memories the other day where, like, a whole bunch of Twilight moms were in the acknowledgments for some book. I forget what it was. But I think I was in Beth Revis's book. Do you remember? I beta read, Across the Universe. Is that the name?
Really?
Of the book?
I think, yeah. Well, that was one of her books, too.
I was in the acknowledgments for that. Because I helped beta read or was like the street team or something.
Yeah.
But I remember there was like a little while where like people we knew would like pop up in acknowledgments and you're like, oh my God, I know them.
I know, right? So.
Literally.
All right. We should talk about some food.
Food.
I have to tell you one of the fun things. If you ever get a chance to go to an Erin signing, she has envelopes of goodies that she sends with every book. Okay. This, normally they're just like basic. Like, here's some cards with characters.
I love, like, character art.
Stuff like that.
I love character art.
But the cool thing is, 13th Child, she has another one she gives away because this is her favorite book. You get an envelope with three candles.
Like, That's so overdramatic.
I didn't break, and I was like, one of my lives is gone. Even better, though, and with fits us so well, she has
cake.
Please tell me birthday cake recipes.
Spice cake in there?
Yeah, one of them is Merrick's cherry birthday cake recipe. This one's like two cards because it's
so involved.
It has so much like ingredients for the filling and the frosting and the cake itself. Yeah. And then Leo's spiced cake recipe. So I'm wondering, I think you could probably, I don't know if Erin wants me to post them. I'll see if she does.
She's going to be in Orlando, Marianne, on the 20th.
You should go meet her because she's so lovely. But it's fun. Everything she like signs and then she pulls out these envelopes that she does on her own. And just like, it just makes you feel really connected. But yeah. I love that one specifically because it was cake recipes. And I was like, and we talk about food. I want to make these cakes.
Enjoy cake.
I would like to try both of these.
We should do someday when I have money again, which will be soon. But we should do like, I don't know, if we decide to go to that zoo or whatever, we should get like an Airbnb instead of a hotel where we can literally just cook all this like food from the different things that we've read. Yeah, yeah. I did love that Leo. Like, I thought that
the spice
more
food.
Than any other moment in the book, like, because I think Leo was fighting with like the, am I an asshole or am I going to be a good guy? I thought that was like the moment where you're like, oh, he is a good guy because he notices that she doesn't eat sweets. Like she will eat them, but they're not like her favorite. And then she really only has to tell him once that like my mom used to make the spice cake, never for my birthday, but like it was what she made for
everybody else.
And it has like a special place in my heart for him to go, I can do that for you. Like that.
It sounds delicious too. This sounds delicious.
Thing with it was that I would think it bring back bad memories of not being included. That's the thing that got me with that whole thing with the spice cake. It would bring back bad memories of everybody else in the family getting a cake except for her. But
I think it's probably twofold. I think it's like some nostalgia of like it's like the scent of home, even like the smell of the spice cake cooking. And she did get along with her siblings. Like, it's not like, her parents kind of, like, neglected her. But she did get along with Birdie and, like, and I think some of it is, you know, she says, this is a thing that I like, taste-wise. It reminds me of home. It reminds me of being part of a family, even though I never had it for myself. And Leo went, I can do that. Like, I can make you this cake and it's yours.
Yeah.
And, well, it could tie you to your family.
One of those truly screwed up things with, I mean, child trauma, too.
Yeah.
Where you're connecting something bad, thinking it could be something good because it's the only connection you have.
Yeah.
In a sense. So I was kind of like, well, maybe like.
And it even the way you just said that made me think of Summer in the City when we talked about changing memories, like by experiencing things in new ways. So like changing her negative association with New York City into something positive by like making new memories.
Yeah.
Along the same lines of her being like, I like this cake, even though it's not all happy memories, and him going, we can make happy memories. Like we can build our own.
Yeah.
And he does like across years, you know, because spoiler alert, they end up together. But he makes her spice cake every year.
Until they're 99.
Yeah. But on the flip side of that, though, is Merrick being completely obtuse and making what he thinks she would like. And every year she's like, it's yummy. But really, and we don't know that she doesn't like the cake until Leo asks.
Right. And that just shows how attentive
we don't know.
And it shows how attentive he is to her, you know, how much she matters to him.
And once she confirms that, like, I don't actually really like super sweet stuff. If you think back to all the things she says about the cake prior to that, like Merrick's cakes, it's always how much he has a sweet tooth. She never makes reference to how much she enjoys it.
Yeah.
She's excited because the cake means Merrick's there.
Yeah.
And that someone is celebrating her birthday, but she only ever references how much Merrick enjoys the very, like, dessert.
I feel like it took me half the book to realize, too, that she didn't like sweets because she always talks about Merrick having a sweet tooth and, oh, it's my cake again and blah, blah, blah. But I was wow, she doesn't really like it, does she?
I thought that was really well played out because once you realize that she doesn't like it, you're like, oh, I didn't notice either.
Yeah.
Like, because it wasn't a hidden fact.
She didn't make it a big deal.
Yeah. And she never says she doesn't like it, but you realize kind of in live time, she also never says she likes it.
Right.
And we missed it as the audience.
Right.
We didn't pick up on it either.
Yeah.
I thought that was well played. I like that a lot.
For sure. For sure.
Yeah. All right. What about the places?
I was saying, we probably don't need to talk more about food because it's just cake. That's it. That's pretty much it. It's just going to make us all hungry.
Right. That's I'm not going to lie. That is why I had key lime pie earlier because I was like,
pie, sweets.
I was going through my notes and I was like, oh, we're going to talk about sweets. Oh my God, I have that key lime pie. I had to eat it today. You know, I'm going to eat it right now. But it was because of this book. Anywho, back to places.
Yeah, lots of, I love a good made up world.
Me too.
And this one's very French, I feel like. This has a lot of French feeling. And so I wonder. I don't know if Aaron ever, maybe if you do opera, you've learned French.
I thought it was very French as well.
Like Alatois, the guys, the names, Margot spelled the French way, E-A-U or A-U-X. What's her last name? Trepe, T-R-E-P-A-I.
I liked all the locations in this one. And I also liked that it was like a variety of locations. And done in such a simple way. Like you got through Hazel, you got a very clear look at all the different ways people lived in the area. Like you got poverty.
Yep.
You got ignoring the in between for a hot second, but you got poverty. You got kind of a small provincial town.
Mm-hmm.
Very Belle. And then you got the capital and the palace. Like you got a very clear look at kind of how all the different socioeconomic classes. Mm-hmm. are functioning during this time.
Yeah.
That's one of the odd things about listening to it on audio is like, I'm a real visual person. And so like the king's name or the name of the towns, I couldn't really picture what they looked like until like I saw them in our show notes and I was like, that's what it was.
Oh, that's how you spell that.
Yeah.
That I would say a lot of times because of time or if I'm really into a book, I want to do nothing but read it. So I read it and I listen to it.
Right.
And I read it like, I'm like, okay, I stopped at this chapter, Spotify. I'm on chapter 42. I'm on chapter 47 and I go back to read it. So I liked that too, because as I was reading it, I saw it, but then I heard it pronounced.
Right.
And I was like, okay, now I got it. So now I'm saying it correctly in my head and all that. So
I definitely am saying 90% of the words in this book incorrectly in my head because I did not listen to it.
Those are my favorite memes, especially the Sarah J. Maas ones because the words are so... And they're like me reading Sarah J. Maas universe in my head. And it's saying that these names just crazy. And then like listening to it. This is what it really sounds like.
I think one of my biggest videos on TikTok, like on my personal account, was me watching Bridgerton and realizing how you pronounce the Viscount.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Because it's got an S in it. So in my head, I had
Viscount?
Always, like Viscount. Viscount. Yeah. And I was like, but I wouldn't have known it was the same word except for I had the subtitles on. And I was like, that's how you pronounce it. I was like, I made a whole video about it. I was like, please tell me I'm not the only one.
Huh?
But I definitely, if I listened to this book, I'd be like, oh, that's how that's pronounced.
So many things like that. The difference, you know, they talk about between like you tell people who read because we mispronounce words all the time.
Yeah.
For years, I thought it was macabre.
Yeah.
Oh, for sure.
Because macabre is M-A-C...
A-B.
A-B-R-E. Like, macabre. There's a B-R-E, and you don't say it. It's just macabre.
Yeah. No, thank you. No, that's not correct. Not in my head.
So I'm like, wow, I've read a lot of Gothic literature, and wow, I've been saying macabre the whole time.
Yes.
You know the one that bothers me? You order a panino, because that's singular. Panini... It's plural.
Well, same thing with canola.
If you say panini, you want multiple ones.
And same with canola.
It's a panino.
Technically with canola,
too. I mean,
let's
be honest. I do want multiple ones.
Yes,
like, if we're being
true.
Honest.
All of the above. Give them all to me.
Yeah, I'll take more than one. It's fine. That actually sounds delicious for dinner.
It does.
I just remember
we have a food problem.
Anywho, about the locations, I think I've said anywho like 7 times in this one because we keep getting very sidetracked.
That's okay.
But about the locations. Any other thoughts on the locations besides the fact that...
I think it's funny you put in that she lives in a barn for a while.
I think it was an important note.
It is important, yeah.
But she chose to do it.
Yes.
Because she wanted a space of her own.
Yes.
I thought that
which goes
that
back
was,
to that solitude that she does kind of...
And why she was like, okay, in the in-between, which I loved the in-between. I was like, what a great...
Well, doesn't she have that conversation with Merrick at 1.2 where he's like, I thought you were okay because you've always lived alone. And she goes, but you were supposed to be here. Like, that was the whole point.
The whole time. Even when I was living in a barn,
you were supposed to come get me. And that was supposed to be...
Yeah.
Like us hanging out and you just dumped me into this place and it's great. And yes, I can get along alone. Doesn't mean I want to.
Right. Yes. I thought that was also very well done.
But I do love that he gets her a dog.
I know.
I can't be there. I'm going to buy you a puppy.
But here's your puppy. And the puppy's like the size of a bear. Yeah, like it ends up being like ginormous.
Pictured like an Irish wolfhound kind of thing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Big like that. So.
Sure.
Okay, how about our final thoughts on this one then?
I think I've kind of already said, like, this is going to be very repetitive, my final thoughts, because I've already said these things. But again, this is one of my favorite books. I want to read a million more books set in this world. I would read a book about Leo and Hazel's like lives, like after the end of this book, I would continue reading about the two of them. I want to know way more about Birdie. I want a whole backstory on Merrick. I would even be interested in what's the older sister, Leo's older sister's name?
Bellatrix.
Well, she's Bellatrix.
Yeah.
Bellatrix.
I want a story about her. Like I want to know so much more about all these.
Or how about the queen? Because the queen, was dallying.
Yes. She had a side piece.
Yes.
And but also
as her husband's brother. Yeah.
Like how that gets, I want to know way more about the Holy First. I would listen to like a whole story about the fracture. Like I just want way more about this entire world.
It's just the whole world with the gods and everything. I find it really, like if you've read Divine Rivals.
Yep.
That series and stuff. Same thing. Like they live in this cool world, but these gods are there. I want to know more about that. I think not from a religious aspect. For me, it's a literary. Like I said, I like Greek and Roman gods
and
stories.
I
like that kind of stuff.
It's all pieced together. Like, how do they relate to each other? How do they relate to the mere mortals that are like under their charge?
The world, how it works together. Yeah. 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 Same thing. I love it. It's perfect for fall. I just love Erin's writing and her descriptions. I love Fractured Fairy Tales. The kind of book I definitely would like to read again because I think it's not an intentionally missing things, but you just miss things.
Can confirm.
And then you go again, and then you're I loved, so.
Can confirm. On second read, I was like, I missed that the first time. And also, once you know the ending, you pick up on different things.
Other
that
things
are like,
earlier, yeah.
Yeah, that, yeah. You're like, so that's how that fits together.
Yep. Yep. How about you, Ma?
Same, like I said earlier, it's not necessarily something I would have chosen, but, and again, being repetitive, but like this whole conversation, just the fact that a book like this has so many different layers and having the people that you can discuss it with and learn from them and, you know, see things that you didn't see before. That's just the beauty of like the whole book community that, you know, that even as maybe not a book you would have chosen yourself, but having somebody else open your eyes to it and giving the opportunity to discuss it was definitely a very positive thing. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
We probably ought to wrap this up.
Right. It is time for us to reveal our featured book for November with a few clues. I feel like our first major clue is that this is one of all three of our favorite books of all time.
It's my all-time favorite book.
If you can't guess based on that, you haven't been listening to us enough. But 100%. Clue number one. On an island that smells of salt and danger, two riders risk everything. One for freedom, one for survival.
Clue two. They rise from the water, sleek, wild, and hungry. To ride them is to gamble with your life.
Clue number three, the sea calls every November, and those who answer are never the same.
And drum roll, please. Our November book is The Scorpio Races by Maggie Stiefvater. Our episode will go live on November 18th. Tune in on your favorite streaming services.
I love this book so much.
Did I say her name?
I know. I've read this book like 20 times, and I'm so excited to read it again.
I'm so excited.
Did I say her name right?
Place.
Yes.
Maggie Stiefvater?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Okay.
Yes.
I mean, I took German for 400 years, but
I know.
It's a long time ago.
Wait, if you listen to it, Maggie composed the music.
Oh, that's right. I remember that.
She also made the book trailer. Like,
yes, I remember that.
The animated book trailer.
The animated book trailer.
So, okay.
Guys, those of you that are going to listen next month, be ready because we have so many happy thoughts about this book.
Might be like a 5-hour episode.
It's the longest episode. But anyways, that's it for now for this one. Thank you to everyone for joining us as we talked all about The 13th Child, which is another amazing book. So glad we picked it.
So many good books this year.
So many.
If you enjoyed this episode, please head to our profile. Check out the other books we've featured so far. Things like Perfect Marriage, Lessons in Chemistry, Come Fly With Me. And if you're looking for book recommendations each month, we share what books we've read across every genre.
And don't forget to follow our socials, subscribe to the podcast, and please leave us a review. We want to know what you think.
And as always, if there is a book that you love that you think we should read or we should feature with the book club, please let us know. Our TBRs need to be bigger. Let's be honest.
Right.
We're only going to read a book next month that we've all read like 50 times, but who cares? We're going to read it again.
Why not?
And continue to buy more.
Everyone should read it.
So until next time, keep reading,
keep exploring,
and don't forget to pack the snacks.
Yeah.
The cake.